And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, joined by Tom Fornelli, and this is the Rewind edition of the podcast. We will sit down at the end of every college football weekend and break down the biggest stories, some of the games, as well as try and give you an idea of maybe some of the things that you missed. Tom and I have eyes all across the country as we try to break down and condense what 125 FBS teams are able to do. And Tom, before we jump into this, you know, I say FBS, I think one of the stories of our first weekend of college football is the FCS.
The little engines that could went out and did do it.
So yeah.
That was good English right there that I used, actually. That's why I'm a writer. They did do it. But, yeah, there's a whole lot of FBS teams falling to FCS teams this weekend, and it's kind of fun.
Yeah, a little bit fun. I think the total was 8, and that includes 2 wins against Big 12 teams, 2 wins against American teams, and 8 FCS wins over an FBS team over FBS teams is getting close to the number that we might see an entire season, and yet we saw it here on this first weekend. Certainly one of the most exciting portions of it, and if I may plug a CBSSports.com piece, my man Tom Fornelli broke it all down for you, and you should go and check it out, right?
Yes, you should. You should read everything I write or anybody on the Eye on College Football blog writes, because it's amazing.
We're going to get things started this year on The Rewind. We're going to kick off each show with The Hangover. Tom and I are recording this right now on Sunday, so we apologize to the fans of Louisville, Ohio, Colorado, Colorado State, Florida State, and Pittsburgh, because I'm sorry. I understand you wanted the TV time, but you're just not going to make the cut for the Rewind podcast. And when we do the Hangover, what we're going to do is we're going to start with the last thing we had, the games that were freshest in our mind, the late games from Saturday night. In this case, if we were to slowly include it, you could say LSU-TCU, but I mean, we're talking about the mayhem games. We're talking about Boise State-Washington, Nevada-UCLA, Northwestern-Cal. Let's start, Tom, with Boise State, Washington, really one of the worst openers for Boise State since 2007, one of the worst losses in the Chris Peterson era. I mean, it's easy because there have been less than 2 handfuls of losses. But are you changing your idea about Boise State moving forward, or do you think that this is what so many Washington fans have been hoping for, which is a team that could break through that 7-win plateau?
Yeah, I'm changing my opinion more on Washington than I am with Boise State, because although I don't think Boise State this year is quite up to the par of the teams we've seen in recent history, at the same time, I've never seen a Boise State team be dismantled like they were by the Huskies last night. It was startling, and I think it had a lot more to do with Washington finally, you know, being a very good team. I think the Huskies, I think last night kind of served notice to the rest of the Pac-12, particularly the North Division, that the Huskies are going to be around. You know, they got themselves their new stadium that they've redone. It's super cool and loud, and I think this team might make some noise.
I liked how on Twitter, you can follow Tom on Twitter at Tom Fornelli. You mentioned let's see if the stadium still shakes, and I think you were probably all mentioning half the rowdy Washington football fans and half a stadium that was probably not in great condition a couple years ago.
Yeah, the old Husky Stadium wasn't exactly – there was a reason they had to renovate it. It was a great place for a football game, but I don't think it was up to government code.
The inspectors overlooked some things.
Had somebody – you know, had an inspector walked in there at a bad time, you know, they might have had to cancel a season or two.
And, of course, Washington, they spent a quarter billion, billion with a B, dollars on renovating Husky Stadium. Looked very, very nice. I enjoyed that. Gus Johnson on the Fox Sports 1 call. That was certainly one of a fun game to watch get started. But as Washington started to pull away, started to journey around, flip around elsewhere, Northwestern at Cal was really where we all finished. That's another Pac-12 team that just renovated their stadium, Memorial Stadium now, looking pretty cool. Pat Fitzgerald's Northwestern team, there were some accusations about possibly faking injuries as Cal's Bear Raid really got up and rolling, and Jared Goff looked good as a freshman quarterback stepping into a system that probably is still in its infancy, but you can really see the potential with Cal's offense. What was your read, first of all, on Cal in general, and then second, how you thought Northwestern handled both the environment and the attack?
Well, for Cal, what I took away more than anything was that it's the first time in a couple years where I've watched a Cal team that I've actually thought, hey, this could be something. They were fun to watch with the Bear Raid, and the defense still definitely needs some work, but just in general, it wasn't a boring team because Cal was good for a few years, but then the last couple of years, they've been kind of stale. It's been the process. It's just gotten kind of boring where it feels fun again. Even though they lost, it was watching a Cal game. I had a good time, and I haven't seen that in a while. So I think that's good news for Cal fans. I think, eventually those losses are going to start turning into wins. As far as Northwestern goes, Pat Fitzgerald could say that his team wasn't, faking injuries. But anybody who watched that game knows that Northwestern was faking injuries. First, there was a couple times where you saw, I can't remember which player it was, but it was a Northwestern defensive lineman. It was after a play. Cal just got a first down. And he's standing there with his hands on his hips, and he looks over to the sideline. Seconds later, he drops to the floor. All of a sudden, he's got a cramp. He was standing there, and standing there caused him to cramp up. So he drops, and then, of course, the trainers come out, and you can see in the eyes of trainers are like, God, this crap again, come on. And I don't think it's a coincidence. If you'll remember, during the offseason with the targeting rule, which was another big part of the weekend that we saw, in fact, one of Cal's players, Chris McCain, one of their best pass rushers, got ejected from the game in the second half for targeting on what may textbook be against the rule, but in football-wise was just a terrible, terrible ejection. But over the offseason, Pat Fitzgerald had mentioned instead of having ejections, maybe college football could follow soccer and go with like a yellow card and a red card system. Well, apparently Fitzgerald decided to take that idea a step further by having his players fake injuries last night because they were.
It was very European football right there.
Yeah, I was waiting for the trainers to come out with that magic soccer spray that they use in the soccer players when they get hurt
right,
and all of a sudden healed. But yeah, it was. I don't begrudge them for doing it because, hey, the refs, like Brock Hewitt said in the broadcast, the refs weren't doing anything to stop it, and it's on the refs to do it, and they weren't doing it. So if I was, I would be doing the same thing, but they were certainly doing it, and it's also ironic that Cal fans are complaining about it considering 3 years ago it was Cal doing the very same thing against Oregon.
Yeah, that I had a good chuckle out of that one. One other piece of the late-night slate, a game that I did not get quite the watch that I had hoped to. I've got the game recorded, but man, it looked like UCLA's offense, even without Jonathan Franklin, Brett Hundley just stepped in there and they got a big game from Franklin's replacement. But I think they had over 500 yards of offense. Nevada, Cody Fajardo, a lot of expectations of him. I know that new first-year head coach Brian Polian was not going to change the pistol attack. But it just was not enough for a Bruins team that seemed to jump out ahead. And Jordan James, that was the
Jordan, yeah, head. Jordan James, 155 yards.
Yeah, goodness gracious. Did you get a chance to watch more of that game than I did? I've still got it on the DVR right now.
I didn't spend too much time watching it because it was rather apparent when I would peek in. I mean, the first time I checked in, it was still kind of close to the first half. And then I went back to Cal and Northwestern. I checked in the second half, and the next thing I knew, it was 31-13 UCLA. And I was like, all right. This one, I probably don't have to pay much attention to that because at that point, UCLA is up 18 on Nevada. And I think Washington was up about 18 on Boise State late at the same time. So it was from that point on, I kind of just put all my focus on the Northwestern Cal because it was getting silly and fun.
Yeah, another note here also, on this very podcast, on an earlier show, Bruce Feldman identified Shaq Evans as a player who he thought he was going to have a breakout season. Shaq Evans starts the year with 13 catches, over 100 yards receiving. Very impressive performance there. All right, we're going to go from our hangover, the latest games on Saturday. And now we're going to take it all the way back to the beginning of the weekend, Thursday night. Of course, it got kicked off with the much-anticipated 2013 debut of the South Carolina Gamecocks and their All-American defensive end, Jadeveon Clowney. First of all, South Carolina pretty much dominates in the game. There are times where North Carolina appears to threaten. The offense got rolling. But the story coming out of it, unfortunately, commentators across the country, and I know we were both asked in radio hits on Friday and Saturday morning, what was the deal with Jadeveon Clowney's conditioning? Really, it seemed to me like there was a conditioning issue everywhere just because it was 95 degrees in South Carolina. I mean, it was humid, it was hot, and I know Bruce Ellington, the South Carolina wide receiver, made mention of it in the postgame availability. He said, listen, everybody was struggling out there. North Carolina players were cramping up. Did you think that the complaints about Jadeveon Clowney's conditioning were fair or foul?
I think they were fair as far as the fact that Clowney talked about how he was conditioning all offseason and that, you know, he even admitted last year he took plays off and he wasn't going to do that this year. I think as far as that concerns, they were fair because he was, you know, he was having problems, especially considering it's the first game of the year, and I know it was hot and humid, but you need a while to get in football shape. This isn't like the NFL where these kids have four preseason games to play before the real stuff starts. So I don't think it should be held against him, although I get why it was mentioned, although I think ESPN kind of pushing the whole Clowney narrative was hammering it over the head a bit too much. But what I found really interesting that I didn't think was very fair at all was last night during the Clemson-Georgia game, Herb Street started talking about Clowney during like a segment break or whatever. And Herb Street said that Clowney was taking plays off because he didn't want to get hurt and ruin his draft stock, which I think speculatively is not something you should be reporting out of. You know, that might be some talk radio stuff in the local hometown, but to say that on national television when you don't have any evidence of that being the case, you're literally saying, I think he doesn't care. I think he's just trying to stay healthy for the NFL. I thought that was grossly unfair on Herb Street's part.
It was unfair and definitely surprising from someone like Herb Street, because, like you say, that's something.
Herb Street's got an awful hot sports takey in the last few years. Did you notice that? He used to be so super vanilla and middle down the road. But the last few years, he's just coming out. He's like Baylessing it up on the air.
I would not be surprised if he, like so many other talent figures in the sports media industry, are being strongly encouraged to come with hot sports takes that are just so piping hot you need oven mitts.
Singeing. Singes your ears when you hear them.
And what about the Gamecocks in general? They had the offensive line was really impressive to me, something that I hadn't necessarily thought about. They will not have such an incredible size advantage in the trenches in the SEC like they did have against North Carolina, a team that is a little bit undersized, a little inexperienced on the offensive line, undersized on the defense for their sort of 4-2-5. They like to be a little bit more hybrid and multiple. And actually, South Carolina outweighed North Carolina by about 50 pounds per person. That was very well publicized during the broadcast. But are you more impressed by the Gamecocks and as far as your expectations for them in the SEC?
Well, they've been my favorite in the East the entire time, but I think I kind of solidified that opinion on Thursday night because that was a very good, you know, Larry Fedora's offenses have never been bad. And that was, you know, a good North Carolina offense that they were facing on Thursday night. And it was using tempo in that kind of, you know, heat and in that humidity where a defense could really struggle. Because you mentioned they had 50 pounds, you know, per player on average. Well, that extra weight hurts you in those conditions too. So I feel like even though Clowney had an off night, the fact that South Carolina's defense still played that well is a very good indicator for this how the season's going to go. The offense could struggle on certain nights because there's still some aspects of it where I'm kind of like, you know, eh. But I think Spurrier's kind of the same way, which is why he's always yanking a quarterback in and out, just like, eh, let's see which one works this time. But I still have them as my favorite in the SEC East.
And in that game, I mean, it's interesting because they will turn around, and I'd like to come back to Clemson, Georgia here in a little bit. But let's go ahead and look at that SEC East and the SEC in general. Obviously, Alabama's victory over Virginia Tech, LSU's victory over TCU, Texas A&M, Johnny Manziel comes back, they take care of Rice, South Carolina over North Carolina, Florida takes care of Toledo, and then Georgia falls to Clemson. How are you sorting out each of those two division races, and would you take someone like an Ole Miss, which came out with a very dramatic win over Vanderbilt, do you consider them a player now after sort of watching all of the contenders in that conference? How are you sorting them out in your mind?
I still don't put Ole Miss in the top three of that division in the West. It was a nice win over Vandy, but it was still kind of a game at the end that was a little bit insane and super fun. It was a great way to start the season for the college football fan. But it's still a very young team. They've already got some injuries with the other Khemdiche. I think that's what he'll be referred to for most people by now, the other Khemdiche. He's going to be out for a while. They lost an offensive lineman for the season. It's still a very young team. And although they beat Vanderbilt, and that's impressive, Vanderbilt is still not exactly, you know, the standard bearer of the SEC. So beating Vandy is nice, but it doesn't do much to me to prove that this team's going to be a force in the SEC West. For me, it's still Bama, LSU, and A&M. And from what I saw on Alabama last night, I think they showed they're not invincible, but I still have a solid feeling that they're the best team in the country by far. The offensive line is a little, you know, there's still work to be done, but it's Alabama, and I have supreme confidence that it'll get worked out. Plus, Virginia Tech's front seven might actually be one of the best front sevens in the country all season long.
Yeah.
So I don't think we should take those concerns too seriously. When it comes to LSU, the Tigers are still the Tigers. It's going to be every game an adventure. The defense is still very stout. The running game was good last night. Zach Mettenberger was thoroughly mediocre. And it's the defense is going to keep them in, and they're going to be in close games. They're going to be in strange games where the referees can't decide how much time is left on the clock at the end of the first half and whether or not they should be allowed to kick a field goal or not. And then they will let them kick a field goal because Les Miles will use his magic powers. And then there's Texas A&M, and the thing I took away from Texas A&M, everybody's going to be talking about Manziel, and I'm sure we actually will be talking about him soon enough, but what worries me more than anything, what I took away from that game was Texas A&M's front seven on defense was getting blown up by Rice offensive line.
Yeah.
And that is not something that should be happening. Like, if Rice is airing it out and just, you know, getting, you know, some touchdowns and keeping it a game, fine. But that offensive line was pushing the A&M front seven backward. And that was not something I expect to see. And that was something that I think that once the Aggies get into SEC play, Manziel or no Manziel, I think that's going to be a big problem for the Aggies. Two losses is looking a little tough if the defense doesn't improve in a hurry. As far as the East goes, I mentioned South Carolina, everything over there already with the defense looking great. What surprised me was, I mean, I know it was against Toledo, but Toledo's a good MAC team, and Florida's offense actually looked relatively competent yesterday.
Yeah,
and
I'm
wondering
play.
If the Gators, you know, can dare to dream, might they actually be able to put points on the board consistently? Mac Brown, who was not recruited to Texas as a safety or didn't recruit any quarterbacks to Texas as a safety, had a very good day on the ground. We've seen that they've already got a threat in the running game with Brown. The receiver is still going to need some time, but, you know, Purifoy being out, you know, I think that could gel in the future. And then Georgia, the loss to Clemson, they played well. The defense, the secondary, we knew that was a problem coming into the season. It was a problem for them last year. That needs to improve. And I don't know if it will, but what worries me more about Georgia right now than anything is – you can excuse the loss to Clemson, but I don't know if they could afford the loss to Clemson because this week they face South Carolina. Then they get North Texas the week after that. But after North Texas, they get LSU. So we're looking at a possibility that after 4 weeks, Georgia could be 1-3.
Yeah. And for a team that started number five, that was 5 yards away from playing for the BCS title a year ago, that is not going to be a spot that Georgia fans want to be in October, already looking like they're not only out of the national title race, but they're also out of the SEC title race.
Yeah, and they're looking at, like, you know, the Independence Bowl or something.
Oh, yeah. If they're not on New Year's Day, then this is going to be a problem.
Yeah, it won't be Mike Bobo's name coming out of the fans' mouths for people they want fired much longer if that's what happens.
All right, so what about that South Carolina-Georgia game? Because South Carolina, a little bit more time to prepare, a little bit more time to rest. I don't know how much you want to chalk that up to. But Georgia just played an exhausting game against Clemson. Both teams, I think Georgia had more total plays on offense than Clemson, but both of them were over 70. Up-tempo, a very, very exhausting game with some of the best athletes in the country. Do you see them answering at home in Sanford Stadium against a South Carolina team that admittedly, particularly Connor Shaw as a quarterback, very different efficiency numbers away from home than in Willie B?
Yeah, I think that next week's game, the most interesting aspect will be the South Carolina defense versus Gurley and Marshall, because that was, for me, that was the highlight of Georgia's night last night, was watching that running game, because those are two good running backs, and they are very fast running backs. When Gurley broke off at that 75-yard touchdown run early, and he was running away from people at speeds that I feel like kids his size should not be able to move. But what also concerns me is, I got this stat actually from Feldman's Big Picture column today, and I didn't realize it until I read it this morning. After last night's loss to Clemson, Aaron Murray is now 1-9 in his career as a starter against top 15 teams.
Whoa.
Yeah, and so I feel...
That's a problem.
Yeah, that's a trend.
Yeah.
When you've only won 10% of your games against top 15 teams, that's something to worry about. So I know they're at home next week, but I think I'm giving the slight edge to South Carolina just off from what I've seen the first 2 weeks, because Georgia's going to be facing a much better defense. I know that Connor Shaw isn't as good on the road, as you mentioned, but I still don't think Georgia's defense is very good. So I feel like South Carolina's got a better chance to, you know, score more than Georgia, and that's what it comes down to.
So trend up points for South Carolina and Florida, trend down points for Georgia. And I'm agreeing. I think that you and I agree this is not just because of the result, but more of the way it happened, right, for Georgia?
Yeah it's not. I mean, like I said, losing to Clemson is nothing to be ashamed of, not like it used to be. You wrote last night, this Clemson's no longer just, you know, it's not the reputation, it's the results, and they're posting the results.
Yeah. Another thing about A&M and that defense against Rice, certainly worth mentioning, when they play LSU, while Zach Mettenberger did not exactly blow anybody away with his passing, the offense as a whole still put up 448 yards against a TCU defense that was number one in the Big 12 last year. They, and especially Terrence McGee, look, LSU's just got another running back. Where are they getting these guys? And then, so I think that could be a problem, of course, against Alabama when you're going up against TJ Yeldon, and definitely could be a problem again trying to stop the rushing attack of LSU. A&M rush defense, certainly a place for concern. Unfortunately, we're not going to, you know, get a chance to see whether or not they're going to take a step forward. They play Sam Houston State as a little bit of a warm-up before the great showdown on September 14th when they go up against Alabama.
Listen, if A&M's front seven doesn't get its act together before that game, and I mean, it's going to be hard for them to do it, Alabama's going to run right the hell over them. I'm just...
just telling you.
It's not going to be... It's not. I mean, Manziel and the offense might make it interesting, but there's... Alabama is going to do to what they did to Notre Dame, because honestly, that's what Texas A&M's front seven looked like to me last night watching against Rice. They looked like Notre Dame getting blown off the ball by Alabama, and that's not something that should be happening.
Not against Rice.
No.
Yeah. All right, let's go. All right, Tom, for better or worse, you know, good or bad, what are our two or three performances by teams coached by first-year coaches that stood out to you during week one, and why?
First, I'm going to go with Tommy Tuberville at Cincinnati.
Big win.
Because, yeah, that seems to be a program where things are going to keep chugging right along like they have under D'Antonio, Brian Kelly, and Butch Jones before him. And while what surprised me was, because the offense was nice, they put up 42 points on Purdue. But I think what's really stood out to me more than anything was it was the first time in a while where we could see a Tommy Tuberville team and point to its defense, because he certainly couldn't do that at Texas Tech. But they held Purdue to only 7 points, and the 7 points that Purdue got was on a touchdown drive that only came after a muffed punt gave them the ball at the 11-yard line. So it was an 11-yard touchdown drive. So it was just a very impressive performance from the defense all around. So thumbs up to Tubbs there. I'd also go with Rod Carey at Northern Illinois, because like Tubbs at Cincinnati, it seems Northern Illinois is going to roll no matter who's running it. And unlike Dave Doran, he was actually able to beat Iowa. So that was an unnecessarily mean jab at Dave Doran. It sounded worse than I meant it. But.
You're just trying to say positives for Rod Carey. I understand.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, Dave Doran. I didn't mean it that way. But I'm just saying they were able to finally hold on and hold off Iowa. It actually came back to beat Iowa this year. And we'll talk. I think we could do a separate podcast in Iowa one day, just because that's wow. But I also wanted to mention Sonny Dykes, who I mentioned earlier, for the same reason, because Cal's looking, you know, more interesting. So credit to him for that. But on the other side of it, the coach I wanted to mention was the coach on the other sideline from Tuberville of Daryl Hizell with Purdue. And as I mentioned in our Big Ten preview last week, I think he's the right hire for that program as far as getting it, you know, making it a contender in the Big Ten every year. But as we saw on Saturday against Cincinnati, and as I mentioned, there is a lot of work to be done before that can be the case, because he inherited a program that needs a lot of work.
Yeah. And I was impressed, particularly in that game, Cincinnati offensive coordinator Eddie Grand. I could be wrong about this, but he's been an assistant coach for like 25 or 26 years. And yes, I think this is one of the first times that he has been calling plays, being an offensive coordinator. The Bearcats go into halftime only up 14-7 or 10-7.
It was 14-7, I believe.
And then things just completely turn around. Munchie Legault, who got the starting position, really because Brendan Kay was a little bit banged up, but he comes in, has a very big game, and I do believe that he will be the starter for Cincinnati's next game. Gunnar Kiel, Notre Dame quarterback, is redshirting this year. Like you said, just seeing the entire makeup of everything in that Cincinnati game, that was against a Big Ten opponent. That was a convincing win. I have no reason right now to change my thoughts on Cincinnati as an annual contender in that conference, where they should be number one or number two pretty much every year.
Yeah, and next week Cincinnati gets to play Illinois, so that's going to be another Big Ten win that they can probably chalk up on the resume, because when you saw Illinois play last night compared to the way Cincinnati played yesterday, Bearcats are going to have another blowout win next week.
Shieldhouse absolutely stepped up. Career high 416 yards. I do not think he's going to be named the CBSSports.com Offensive Player of the Week, but he certainly is going to get a name mentioned in the Also Considered.
I'll just say that, I mean, it was against Southern Illinois, so he shouldn't take it too seriously, but I will say that Shieldhouse for Illinois yesterday had over 400 yards, which was a third of his total passing yards from 2012. He also had two touchdowns, which represents half of his touchdowns from 2012. So he practically had half a season in one game last night for the Illini.
Hey, the Illini needed every single yard.
They needed every single one of those yards.
All right, overreaction time. One surprising result that has changed your outlook for a team, and then one surprising result where you think other people are going to overreact and you are not going to quite make a move yet?
We've already pretty much gone over it already, but I think A&M's front seven has legitimately changed my outlook on how that team's going to be.
Oh, yeah. Agreed. Absolutely.
And I'll say for people who are overreacting, Part A, I got two parts. People overreacting will be to Johnny Manziel. But I would say the other overreacting part is Oregon State's loss to Eastern Washington, because Oregon State's a better football team than the team that lost to Eastern Washington yesterday. And Eastern Washington is also just a very good FCS team. So I think Oregon State's still going to be a solid team in the Pac-12. They're not going to win the Pac-12 North, but they're still going to be winning 7-8 games and going bowling. So you shouldn't take that loss a bit too seriously. I don't think it's as bad of an omen as Kansas State's loss was to North Dakota State. Because even though North Dakota State's the best FCS team out there, Kansas State kind of looked a little lost.
Yeah. Potential injury to Brandon Cooks, wide receiver. That could be a big deal for Oregon State moving forward.
That's a bigger deal than the loss to Eastern Washington.
Yeah, I absolutely. Absolutely agree there. Anything else from the first day that stood out before we look ahead to week two?
I was so happy to have a full Saturday of football.
All right, what are you looking forward to in week two? A week that, looking at the schedule, we've got the South Carolina Georgia game. There's Notre Dame Michigan. But other than a few notable games, there's a lot of, oh, that's kind of interesting. It's a little bit of a drop down in watchability from week one, in my opinion.
Yeah, the week two slate's a little light compared to what we got this week. But I think the Georgia South Carolina game is far and away the most interesting game of the schedule, because it is, you know, two. I don't know how far Georgia will fall in the rankings, but they'll still be ranked. So it's two ranked teams. South Carolina might be top five team. It'll definitely still be in the top 10. And then I am interested in Notre Dame, Michigan, just because I grew up watching Notre Dame, Michigan, and both teams will be ranked. So I think that's one of the more appealing games. And the rest are kind of just, you know, like the main teams that played main opponents this week, you know, the heavyweights that play heavyweights are all playing lightweights next week as a recovery. So there's a whole lot of
I go through the schedule and I try and see, you know, where is a game where I feel like I can learn something about a team. And I did not see a ton, but thankfully, I'm sure that we will be surprised once again, because as this week showed us, we don't know anything.
Who's playing FCS teams next week? I think we should probably take note of that. Let's see if that happens again.
Let's do. Remember, you can get all of the CBSSports.com Eye on College Football podcasts before they are posted to the site. If you subscribe on iTunes while you're there, be sure to review and rate it. But for example, this podcast that you're listening to right now will be available to our iTunes subscribers on Sunday, while it will not be posted until first thing Monday morning to the CBSSports.com site. So if you want to be the first one with your ears on that hot fire, make sure that you subscribe and you'll be getting it right on Sunday and all through the week. As soon as podcasts are uploaded, they'll be delivered to you. For Tom Fornelli, please follow him on Twitter at Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson on Twitter at Chip_Patterson. Thanks for listening to another edition of The Rewind on the Iron College Football Podcast. We'll be right back.